Just to mention before we begin the share this evening, next week we will not be having a share. I'll be traveling, Meir Hashem, for the yeshiva, so I'll be overseas. So we will resume Bezrat Hashem in 2 weeks' time. So we have the Parsha of Baal Osecha, which opens, and in fact it encompasses and comprises many topics. But it opens, famously, Baal Osecha Saneros, with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. As we often note, the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash is unusual in that it is mentioned no less than three times, possibly four, depending on how you reckon it. We find it in the in Chumash Shemos, in the beginning of Parshas Tetzaveh. We find it in Chumash Vayikra, the end of Parshas Emor, and a third time in Chumash Bamidbar, the beginning of Parshas Baal Osecha. Needless to say, each time with a different inflection, with a different emphasis. But this is the mitzvah mishuleshes of Hadlakas HaMenorah. And I'd like to focus on a very interesting discussion that really takes place in the wake of a statement of the Gemara as amplified by the Rambam. If that sounds like more names than facts, so let's get down to business. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma, on Daf Kaf Dalet Omed Beis, in the context of its discussion, makes the following statement about the lighting of the menorah. Namely, says the Gemara, Hadlokas Haner, Lav Avodohi. It's not an avodah. Now, what does that mean? I mean, it takes place in the Beis HaMikdash. But we know that there are one or two things, really isolated matters, that take place in the Beis HaMikdash. We would call it, within the broader scheme of things, part of the avoda of the temple service, but those stages don't yet have the designation of avoda. What is a classic example? Shechita. The shechita of a korban is not yet avoda in this, the sense that we're about to see. The Gemara says that even a non-Kohen can do the shechita of a korban. Rashi even seems to imply that it's desirable for the owner of the korban, even if he's not a Kohen, to do the shechita. So in other words, as much as in a very general sense, of course, the shechita of the korban is the beginning of the avoda, but strictly speaking, that act, that stage, doesn't have the status of avoda. And the Gemara says the same thing about the lighting of the menorah. It's not considered to be an act of avoda. And taking this idea to its logical conclusion, the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, in Hilchos Bios Mikdash, Perek Tes Halacha Zayin, states that it would be permissible for a non-Kohen to light the menorah. As the Gemara said with Shechita, if it's not an avodah, so a non-Kohen can do it. Now, needless to say, there it would seem to be a practical concern here. Namely, the menorah is in the Heichal, it's in the sanctuary, it's in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. A non-Kohen is not allowed to enter the building of the Beis HaMikdash. But the Rambam has anticipated this idea, or this question, and the Rambam formulates and says, if they would take the menorah out of the Beis HaMikdash to a place where a non-Kohen could be, and then he lights it there, that is completely acceptable. So these are, it's a double-barreled chiddush. Number one, the chiddush, or at least the Rambam is formulating it, that it's permissible for a non-Kohen to light the menorah. I mean, that is already news. And secondly, and the two go together, really, they must go together, is that it's possible to perform the lighting of the menorah even not in the Beis HaMikdash, not in the building where the menorah is meant to be. You can remove it, light it there, and then put it back. That's equally a chiddush. But interestingly, as much as it sounds like the type of thing that no one has ever heard before, from a certain point of view, we have. It just might be that we didn't make a point of it or take note of it sufficiently. Because don't we say in the Al HaNisim prayer for Hanukkah, as we talk about the rededication and the purification of the Beis HaMikdash, V'tiras Mikdashecha, V'lika, and then we say, V'hidliku neiros bechatzros kachecha. They lit lights in the courtyard, in your holy courtyard. I think normally we just gloss over it or consider it to be a flourish of phraseology, but the Chasam Sofer says, based on this Rambam, it's kipshuto. They literally lit the menorah in the courtyard. It's completely acceptable. I mean, they were Kohanim. The Rambam says even a non-Kohen could light it there. And why would they do that? Well, isn't it true that a core theme within Hanukkah is Pirsumi Nisa, is publicizing the miracle, and therefore this is something that they themselves did. The very first publicizing of the miracle through the menorah took place with the original menorah of the Hashmon Aharon. They made a point of lighting it outside. The menorah's back. So that's the classic comment of the Chasam Sofer. If you say, whoever discussed such an idea of the menorah being lit outside of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, it's actually right in front of our eyes, in the words of Yedlikar Neros Bechasros Kashecha. It is true, as the Ritva points out, and as Rishonim ask, the Pasuk does talk about Aaron, right? Daber el Aaron Behalos Chasaneros. However, the Ritva answers that although it is usual for Aaron to light the menorah, and that is why when the Torah describes him lighting, Beha'alosecha, when you light the lights, but the Torah never said that Aaron has to do it. That's the difference, as Rav Kupperman used to point out on many occasions, between Derech Sipur and Derech Tzivui, if the Torah describes something or if the Torah commands something. Often if the Torah describes something, that may be a description of how it would typically be, but it's not an insistence that it has to be that way. And therefore the Torah doesn't say, speak to Aaron and say, ta'ale es haneros, tell him to light the neros. Rather, speak to Aaron and say, when you do, because typically it will be Aaron that does, as surely as Aaron is the Kohen Gadol. Even one certainly doesn't need a Kohen Gadol to light the menorah, a regular Kohen would do as well. There's just one problem. There's a certain seeming point that we have been avoiding so far, which will bring us to yet another chiddush. Namely, how can we say that it's acceptable to light the menorah outside the Beis HaMikdash and then reinstate it or put it back into the sanctuary? Is it not part of the Beis HaMikdash, even if it's not an avoda per se, but is not, even if, let's call it a mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah of the Beis HaMikdash, how can it be done off location? You can take it outside and light it there and then put it back. How is that possible? And it's for this reason that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, in his Chidushim to the Rambam, and others as well, many converged upon this idea within the approach of the Rambam, Chazon Ish, the Rogachev Gaon, and others, is that according to the Rambam, the essence of the mitzvah of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash is not the act of lighting the menorah. It's the state of the menorah being lit and illuminated. This ties in very well with the discussion that we had last week within the context of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. There are two types of mitzvahs. Certain mitzvahs, the fulfillment lies in the action, and with other mitzvahs, the fulfillment lies in the result. We noted that Talmud Torah is both la'asok b'divrei Torah and also the result of accumulating Torah knowledge. In this regard, say these mefarshim, for the Rambam, of course, if you don't light the menorah, it's not going to be lit. But the focus is for it to be lit. That's the fulfillment of the mitzvah, is in the result of the menorah being lit, not in the action of lighting it. That may sound somewhat abstract and esoteric, But this is the reason why it is acceptable to light the menorah outside the Beis HaMikdash and then put it back. Should we ask the question, doesn't the mitzvah of menorah need to be fulfilled in the Beis HaMikdash? The answer, say these Mefarshim, is yes, it does. And it is. Because if the fulfillment of the mitzvah is the result of the mitzvah being, of the menorah being lit, when you reinstate it and put it back in the inside the sanctuary, it's lit. And there you have your mitzvah being fulfilled. Interestingly, as certain Mefarshim point out, once again, with a nuanced eye on the Pasuk, if we actually read the Pasuk with the beginning of Ba'alosachah, which is Perek Ches Pasuk Beis, Daber el Aharon v'amarta elav. Speak to Aaron, say to him, Beha'alosecha es haneros, which is a reference, as we said, to lighting the menorah. El mul p'nei ha-menorah yo'iru shivas haneros. The lights shall be lit. The lights shall illuminate. What we have here are two phrases. The first phrase, Beha'alosecha es haneros, about the lighting, is, as we noted, descriptive. The command comes at the end of the pasuk. Ya'iru shivas haneros. The light shall illuminate. The light shall be lit. And that's the result. So you have, of course, they can't illuminate if they weren't kindled. But the kindling is descriptive, because that's not the core of the mitzvah. The command comes in the result of Ya'iru shivas haneros. Very interesting. And for those who are au fait with the halachas of Hanukkah, even though it's slightly off season, it's noteworthy that this actually is now in contrast with Hanukkah. Because specifically we say with regards to Hanukkah, hadlaka osa mitzvah. The emphasis is on the lighting of the menorah, less so on the result. And that's very interesting, especially as the mitzvah of Hanukkah is there to commemorate, so to speak, the mitzvah of menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, but as we see, they're not exactly the same. And in fact, this taking this discussion one stage further and back to Hanukkah, and it's never too early to prepare for Hanukkah, this will also give us insight into an understanding of the miracle of Hanukkah itself. Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, famously offers three suggestions as to how exactly the oil that was sufficient for one day lasted for 8 days. This, of course, is in the heels of his famous question. I think it's probably the most famous question ever asked by Rabbi Yosef Karo. And that is, why is Hanukkah 8 days long? Presumably, it's to celebrate the miracle of the oil lasting for 8 days. However, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, if there was enough oil for one day, so then it turns out that you have 7 days of miracles, because for one day was enough. Well, I think if you ever want to know why Hanukkah is 8 days long, by this stage, it's probably in order to deal with all of the answers that have been suggested to this question of Rabbi Yosef Karo. But he himself gives three answers to this question, and they are as follows. And again, to understand the background, it's in order to see how there was a miracle even on the first day. Don't think that on the first day it was just business as usual, which means you only have 7 days of miracles. There was even a miracle on the first day. How can that be? After all, there was enough oil for one day. So for the first suggestion of Rabbi Yosef Karo is that they divided the oil into eight, and each day they used an eighth of the oil, which means there was effectively a miracle every day. That's the first explanation, because what should have required a full measure of oil, it sufficed to have an eighth of that amount on each of the 8 days. So that's a miracle every day. Secondly, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, it could be that when they poured out the oil from the jar remained full for those first 7 days. Which means on the one hand, you've poured out a jar full into the menorah, but the jar is still full. So you have your miracle even on the first day. And that persisted until by day eight, they just poured it out, and then that's the oil that they used. So either the jar remained full even after pouring it out on day one, and for all those first 7 days, Or alternatively, and this is the third and final suggestion of Rabbi Yosef Kara, the menorah remained full on those first 7 days. Meaning, for those first 7 days, it hadn't burnt out. It simply remained full. They filled up the menorah on day one, and for the first 7 days, even after the entire night, the menorah was still full, which means they could use it for the next day. And this persisted until day eight, when it finally burnt out. Now, there is a very interesting question with regards to this third suggestion. Namely, again, that even when they filled the menorah, the night was over, it had burnt the whole night, and still the menorah was full. Here is the question. If the menorah is still full when the night is over, that means, presumably, the wick is still burning. Because it's in a menorah full of oil. So now the shaila is, what do they do? Come morning, when it's still a wick in the menorah that's full of oil, but you don't need it to be burning anymore, what did they do? Did they just let it burn? And just let it keep on going? Because if the menorah was full for the first 7 days, it can basically burn uninterrupted for 7 days. Is that what happened? Or alternatively, maybe they extinguished the flame in the morning and then rekindled it in the night. Those are the two possibilities. If the menorah is full, you have these two possibilities. Just leave it alone and let it continue to burn, or extinguish it in the morning and then rekindle it in the evening. The Magen Avraham discusses this question, not in his commentary Magen Avraham to the Shulchan Aruch, but in his commentary to the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni, which is entitled Zayis Ra'anan. And the Magen Avraham is inclined to understand the second way, that they just let the menorah burn uninterruptedly. They didn't touch it until Hanukkah was over, because the menorah is full until the eighth day, and then it burns out, and you have your 8 days. And interestingly, if this is the case, which is quite a new way of looking at the miracle, it turns out that when we say that the oil miraculously burnt longer than it should have, and we normally assume that there's only enough for one day, meaning for one night, but it burned for all 8 nights, that means it burnt 8 times longer than it needed to. It actually burnt basically 15 or 16 times longer than it needed to. Because if they didn't touch it, that means that it burnt through the night and the following day and the night and the day for 7 days, until on the final night it could burn through the night. So actually the miracle factor was doubled. It emerges. But this seems to be, this is the direction that the Magen Avraham is going in, that they lit the menorah once at the beginning and they didn't touch it. The Sfas Emes, the famous Sfas Emes of Gur in his Perush to Maseches Menachos and Daf Peches, says it must be the way that the Magen Avraham says. For halachic reasons, the halacha states that if you have a menorah, a lamp that's burning in the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, if the flame goes out, all the oil that's in there at the time is disqualified from being used again. So even if the menorah stayed full after the first night, it wouldn't help them if they extinguished the flame. Because if they extinguished the flame, they just disqualified it for all subsequent nights. They just ruined the miracle. This is the only oil they have. The only way they'll be able to continue using it is if they don't touch the flame and just let it keep burning day and night, or more correctly, night and day, for 7 days and then the final eighth night. So for halachic reasons, they can't extinguish it. It must be they left it alone. The only problem is, if they left it alone, and I think by this stage we can see where all of this is headed, if they left it alone, so how does it help them for those final 7 days? They need the oil to fulfill the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. Well, they lit the menorah on the first day, but if they didn't touch it for the next 7 days, so then they're not doing the mitzvah of lighting the menorah for the next 7 days. So what good is it for that a miracle occurs, that the menorah keeps lighting? That's good news for the menorah. It's not good news for the Jews, because they're now deprived of the opportunity to light the menorah. They can't go near it for 7 days. However, based on the above analysis, we see that no, They did fulfill the mitzvah for all 8 days, even though they only lit it at the beginning of the first day. How so? Because once again, it depends on how you define the mitzvah. If the mitzvah of menorah is the act of lighting, well then, if you only lit it on day one and you didn't touch it for the next 7 days, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah for those 7 days. But if the fulfillment of the mitzvah is in the state of the lights illuminating, being a light, well, you have that for all 8 days. Normally, in non-miraculous times, you'll need to light it every day in order to achieve that result. On this occasion, it was sufficient to light it on the first day to achieve that result for 8 days. But if the fulfillment of the mitzvah is in the result, that result was there for 8 days, they fulfilled the mitzvah for 8 days. So we see how this idea, it begins in the realm of halacha. Where does a menorah need to be lit? Where is the mitzvah fulfilled? What is the mitzvah? That's a halachic discussion. We see it back in the psukim, the description of the lighting versus the proscription of the being lit, the action and the result. Ba'alosecha saneros versus ya'irishiva saneros. And then we see how it, dare we use the expression, illuminates the entire story of Hanukkah, the miracle, how the mitzvah was done, how the miracle worked, etc. Okay, so having discussed a little bit the opening of the parsha, I want to move a little deeper in to the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph to very opaque episode, which is known as the Kivros Hatava. And it was considered to be one of the significant calamities. It is important, I think, to mention that as much as if you read Chumash Bamidbar, it seems to see that one thing went wrong after the other. But that's because the Pasuk is highlighting all of these significant events in order to learn from them. Don't forget, the Bnei Yisrael were in the wilderness for 40 years, which means on any given day, there wasn't a disaster going on. It's just the Pasuk doesn't talk about it. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. 10 disasters over the course of 40 years, it's 10 too many, but it's not an ongoing thing. If we take a look at the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, so you have the famous Vayibin Soha Aron, and then the first three psukim are the misononim, which are terse in the extreme in the way that they are presented. The pasuk almost doesn't really elaborate at all, in contrast to the Kivros Hatava from pasuk Dalet till the end of the perek, where it elaborates in great detail. And let's have a look at pasuk Dalet. V'asaf sufa shebikibo, the rabble among Bnei Yisrael, his avutava, they were seemingly overtaken by some desire. Vayashuva, it started with them, it didn't end with them. Vayashuva, Vayivku gam Bnei Yisrael. Even Bnei Yisrael, who are the relatively higher echelons of the Jewish people, Vayomu, and they said, Mi yachileinu basar, who will feed us meat? And this now becomes the episode, infamous, of Kivros Hatava. It was a terrible thing, and it had a terrible outcome. But to try and understand a little bit the inception of what's happening in Pasuk Vav. Mi yachileinu basar, who will feed us meat? It's like, it sounds like they can't do without it. And it's a national tragedy. Why? Where does it come from? It's also, as is often the case, very important to not only discuss the bigger questions, but to pay careful attention to the way the pasuk expresses itself. Because the pasuk says, Vasaf sufa shebikirbo, this rabble, whoever they were, his avu ta'ava. Now, his avu ta'ava literally means they desired a desire. But when you think about it, most people who desire a desire. I mean, that's how it works. It's like deciding a decision, lachdit hachlata, or whatever it is, lavod avoda. So, but we do have this verb and the noun of the same thing. Why not just say vayisavu, and they desired? Why is it broken down in this way? His avuta ava, they desired a desire. What else is meant to happen to a desire if not to be desired? That's what they're there for. If we move on just a few psukim, because we have a description of this, they're wailing and mourning, and Moshe complains and says, "How am I going? What am I going to do with them? How am I going to deal with them?" Let's have a look at Pasuk Tet Zion, because Moshe is saying, "How will I provide for them?" And the beginning of Hashem's response, if we see now, Pasuk Tet Zion, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Es foli shivim ish mizikne Yisrael. Gather for me 70 people, from the elders of Israel, Asher Yadata, Kehim Mizikne Ha'am, Vesher Trav. They are the elders, they're those who are most qualified. Velakatar Osam al Ol Mo'ed, Vesyatzvu Sham Imach. And take them, and they will stand by you or near you in the Ol Mo'ed. And Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'yaradati v'dibarti imcha sham, I will then descend and speak to you there. V'atzalti min haruach, and I will extend from the spirit asher alecha, which is on you, v'samti alehem, and I'll place it on them. So what we have here is, it's not just Moshe, but rather Moshe will be joined together with 70 elders. Next Pasuk, it seemingly is back to our topic, which is the request for meat. How is it going to come? And it will be not just one day, not just 2 days, it will be for a month, and you'll be sick of it. And so this is most unusual, because the subject at hand seems to be the nation's desire for meat. The request to that, the response to that, would seem to be in Pasuk Yud Ches, which is addressing that. The psukim of Tes Zion and Yud Zion are seemingly a non sequitur. I mean, they have nothing to do with what we're talking about. They may be of significance and relevance in other contexts and for other reasons. But how do they form the beginning of Hashem's response to the people's request/demand for meat? And many, many Meforshim address, just to get a basic working idea of what is happening in this parsha of Kivras HaTava. We will take our guidance here from the Meshech Chochmah. And Meshech Chochmah says, the man is no ordinary food. Ordinary food has a certain effect on people. And the reason for that is because it partakes of the nature of the food itself. Anything that is alive has a certain level of desire in it. If it's alive and growing, it desires. It desires something. It desires to grow, or to eat, or to something. Animals, of course, we know have desires. But the Meshech Chochmah cites Midrashim, which point out that even plant life has a certain aspect of desire, that it wants something. And because that's true, so if a person ingests that food, he also then partakes of that quality of desire. If the food itself has desire, it will then breed desire within the person. So it is with vegetable life, more so with animal life. Not so with the man. The man came from a different place entirely. I mean, literally came from heaven, but in addition, it partook of different qualities. The Pasuk in Tehillim refers to the man, Tehillim Ayin Vav, as Lechem Abirim. Lechem Abirim, which literally is translated as the bread of the mighty, or the food of the mighty, Lechem Abirim Achal Ish. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma in the eighth parak explains that Lechem Abirim, the food of the mighty, who are the mighty? It's the Malachi Hashares. This is the type of food that Malachi Hashares would eat. And that itself needs to be understood. It is b'chol zot a physical food. Malachim, we understand, they're not physical beings. But it means that its qualities are spiritual. The nourishment that you get from the man is purely in the realm of the spiritual. Just like malachim. It's the food of the abirim. Of the mighty, of the malachi asharis. In the second explanation of the Gemara, and the two really go together, abirim is darshan as the word evarim, in the limbs. Lechem hanivla be'evarim. It was, when you ingested it, it was completely absorbed within the limbs. There was no waste product, because it was such a so spiritual in nature, it gave its nourishment, and there was no waste, there was no byproduct. It was completely absorbed within the person. Now, what is the contribution of such food? What type of nourishment does it provide? Understandably, in the realm of Ruchnius, it's very nourishing. And thus the Medrash says, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, Lo nitna Torah ela le'ochle haman. The Torah could only be given to those who ate the man. They need to have this spiritual orientation through their food in order to receive the Torah. That may well be. But it is predominantly, if not exclusively, developing spiritual capabilities and capacities. But not much going on in the realm of the physical. In other words, what the Jewish people wanted at this stage was, in a sense, to return to physical life. To feel the things that people normally feel after they eat. And that is the closer reading of the expression hisavu ta'ava. Literally, hisavu ta'ava means they desired a desire. Why did they desire a desire? Because they didn't have one. They're feeling removed from the world of desire, which means they're removed from really what we would call the physical world. I mean, they live a physical existence, but they're not operating really in such a physical way. And they felt that they wanted to get back to it. Maybe they were abdicating, or at least abdicating prematurely on what the man was meant to do for them. And that way is considered not correct. But his avu ta'ava means they desired a desire. They wanted to get back that ta'ava. And what's interesting is there's a bit of a reversal here now, because there is a famous statement of the Gemara, I think it's in Maseches Beitzah, and Rashi quotes it here in Pasuk Yud. In Pasuk Yud, the people are described as crying, Boche lemishpachosav, vayishma Moshe es ha'am, Boche lemishpachosav, crying with their families. And what does that mean? Well, of course, on a straightforward level, it just means that the families were crying together. But Rashi feels that he has to add more, because since when do families cry together? I mean, that's not a family activity. How is it appropriate? Why is this a meaningful way of referring to it? The people were crying. They have such a sense of family that they get together and weep. And that's why Rashi says, there's another meaning also, al iske mishpachos. They were crying about their families. They were crying about the type of families that the Torah now prescribes for them, because there were certain family members that they could initially marry that they can't anymore. I mean, there was always a close circle of what's called immoral relationships, even for Ben Noach. That circle is now broadened with the giving of the Torah. So you can't start your family with as many people as you used to be able to, and they were crying about that. But as Rav Kuperman points out in his commentary to the Meshech Chochma, according to the Meshech Chochma, they're losing sight of such desires. And that's why they're crying. It's very different than the way we normally understand. It's not that they're so upset that they can't marry this person, they can't marry Plonis, and they can't marry her. No, it's that they're completely detached from it. It's not affecting them. You can't marry so-and-so and they don't care. But they should care, or they want to care. So sometimes the lack of feeling is more alarming than a negative feeling. And all of this breaks in the cry of the Jewish people when they say "Mi yachilenu basar," we feel that we've done enough in our spiritual development, and we want to get back to physical life. Clearly, that was premature, but in the nation's estimation, as far as they're concerned, the time is right. So Moshe now comes to Hashem with this request. And what are the implications for Moshe? The Gemara tells us in Maseches Tainus and Daf Tes that the man, specifically, the man fell in the merit of Moshe. Right? The famous Shlosha Parnesim Tovim, the three providers, so to speak. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. The Anane HaKovod were in the merit of Aaron. The Be'er, or Be'er Shel Miriam. The well was in the Schus of Miriam, and the man in the Schus of Moshe. Because the man comes in the merit of Moshe, that means Moshe is, so to speak, a conduit for the man coming down and materializing into this world. But because he's the conduit, the man itself takes or partakes of the qualities of Moshe. It's a good fit. In other words, in the same way that Moshe himself is referred to as Ish HaElokim, he's a godly person. He is a physical being, but he's very far removed from mundane physical things. And therefore, right, as everything we know about the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu, the elevated and lofty status of Moshe Rabbeinu, so if the bread comes down through him, that's the type of bread you're going to get. You're going to get Moshe Rabbeinu type bread. The result is man. Good for your ruchnius. Not much going on there in Gashmius. But Moshe isn't really able on his level, so to speak, to bring down any more mundane type of food, because he's up there. He can't bring down food that's down of such a lower quality than him. And that is the deeper meaning behind Moshe's words in Pasuk Yud Gimel, may ayin li basar. I mean, where can I get it from? I mean, I don't have the capacity to be a conduit to bring down such mundane food. So where are they going to get it from? And that's why the first thing that Hashem says, in addition to upbraiding the people and chastising them for making this request in the first place, but the request is granted. But in order for the request to be granted, something has to happen. More people need to gather around Moshe. How is that the response to this whole situation? It's got nothing to do with Din Torah or forming Sanhedrin, but rather the point is that if Moshe is the final, if he himself is the sole conduit for bread that comes down from heaven, it's going to stop at Moshe, and therefore it won't descend any lower than the level represented by Moshe. So you're not going to get normal meat like that. But if a group of people are collected around Moshe, which means that the divine spirit, it then comes down one more iteration. It undergoes a level of physicality one degree further. So these 70, they're quote unquote an attachment to Moshe. And that will then allow the food that comes down from heaven to land and be provided in a more mundane way. These 70 people are special people, but they're no Moshe Rabbeinu. They're elevated people, but they are physical people. And therefore, if they are attached to Moshe, the otzalti min haruach, through that attachment, the bread, the meat and the food can finally land in a way that the people were asking for it. And that is why collecting the 70 people is indeed the first or the prelude to the response of providing bread for the people. This is the first explanation of Meshech Chochma, as we can appreciate many profound sentiments and ideas are to be found in this comment. Having said that, we then move to when the people go to collect, as a follow-up comment for Meshech Chochma. Well, perhaps it's in place, before we get to his final comment, just to see an alternative way of looking at how the 70 elders somehow is in any way apropos of the people's request for meat. Because as we said, the man develops spiritual qualities, not so much physical qualities. And the people felt the time had come just to move back to physical food. Why? Is it just for no quantifiable reason? They just felt they'd had enough, or they'd gone the distance? Perhaps it could be traced to a certain development, which is relatively recent. The people had lost the avoda. Initially, the avoda of Karbonos was in the province of the entire Jewish people, them or their family representatives. However, as a result of the Chet HaEgel, so it's taken away from the people. It now exists within Levi, and specifically with the Kohanim. And the Meshech Chochma suggests that perhaps it's for this reason that the people said, so we don't want to eat man anymore, because it's not helping us, because the man is for people who are developing spiritually. But presumably that means it finds expression in the avoda. As long as the avoda resided with the within the people generally, so the people generally need to develop themselves to that end, and to consume man, to format themselves, so to speak, to perform the avoda. But now we don't have the avoda; it's been taken away from the Jewish people and be given to one tribe. So what is there left for the Jewish people to aspire to spiritually, that they should still continue to eat man? That is why they said, so we should go back to our regular diet. So the question is, were they right? I mean, the avoda has been taken away. Is there meaning in eating man if you can't do the avoda? As far as the people is concerned, no. But that is why the first thing that Moshe is told is, gather 70 elders around you. And what will they form? The first Sanhedrin. And what does that reflect? Excellence in Torah. Are these Levim? Not that we know of. Will they be performing the avoda? Not so far as we know. Are they involved in spiritual pursuits? Absolutely. What does that mean? There is spiritual pursuits beyond avoda. Yes, it's called Torah. In other words, the provision of the original Sanhedrin was in order to encourage and inform the people that that just because the avoda is no longer in your province, it doesn't mean that your spiritual development is over or your spiritual prospects are nixed. Because there's an entire realm of ruchnius, of spirituality, which is called pursuit of Torah wisdom. That is ample reason to continue to eat the man. And that is why this is the first response to the people. If they want the meat, they'll get it. But should they ask, is there any point in us eating the man? The answer is, if you want to be like these 70 elders, they're not in the Beis HaMikdash, but they're in the Sanhedrin. And ultimately, the Beis HaMikdash, as you know, was the setting both for the Kohanim and for the Sanhedrin Gedola. That's a whole world of Ruchnius that should not be ignored or forfeited. So that's a second explanation of Meshech Chochma as to how the Isva Lishivim Ish is the first response to the people's request for meat. But let us move now towards the end of that perek, where things start to unravel somewhat, in Pasuk Lamed Beis, because they're told to collect the meat. Of course, when they do, it's a disaster, and they eat the meat, and then it kills them in the end, as the Pesukim describe. And we move from the broader themes to attention to detail. The full picture always comes out from that classic combination. The pasuk lamed beis vayakam ha'am kaleyomuhu v'chalalayda. The people get up that whole day and that whole night. V'choyem ha'machras and the morrow vayasfu es aslav, and they start to collect the quails. Hamam id asav asar chamorim. It tells that even those who collected just a little bit collected a lot. But it ended very badly. Pasuk lamed gimel habasar odenu ben shinehem. The meat was still between their teeth. Teremi kares, that even before they'd finished their eating or chewing it up. Va'af Hashem chara ba'am, va'yach Hashem ba'am makara ba'am'od. There was a terrible plague. The whole thing was really ill-conceived and ill-fated. The question is, how many people did this? How many people went out to collect? And the pasuk doesn't specify. It says Vayakam Ha'am. The people got up. How many people are the people? It sounds like all of them. It doesn't say all of them, but it doesn't sound like some of them. But the Targum Yonus of Ben Uziel explains that the people who were of little faith, they're the ones who collected. Now, on the one hand, it's possible to identify with what the Targum Yonus says. We assume that it's only those who didn't have much faith that would actually collect the food. Everyone else would know to steer clear of it. It's not going to end well. So we can identify in principle. And moreover, the Pasuk says that they were struck down by a plague. It can't be the entire nation that went to collect, because if the entire nation was not struck down by a plague, so clearly it was only some of them. And the Targum Yonus of Ben Uziel further gives us resolution that it's those who were of diminished faith. Everything is in place except the Pasuk. Because the Pasuk says the people did it. And it didn't say some of the people. It didn't say. So if the Pasuk didn't qualify, as much as we are inclined to qualify the Pasuk, how can it be done? Because it says, Meshech Chochma here, we need to take note of what is called the Tamei HaMikra. Tamei HaMikra, the trop or the cantillation notes, which for the most part, even if we do notice them, are for purely musical purposes, or okay, the cantillation. But one thing they do, aside from the whole idea of the Vilna Gaon, that they have names and they're a perish, and which we've discussed on numerous occasions, but aside from that, they tell you how to group the words. Even without the specific melody of each tune, the primary contribution of the Tamei HaMikra is to tell you how to group the words, which words go together and which words don't. As you can appreciate, you can have the very same words, but if you pause and you group them differently, the meaning will be completely different. The Pasuk says, but this is the example that we like to quote, Kol ha'oseh malacha b'yom ha-shabbos mos yumas. Whoever does malacha on Shabbos will be killed. Where should you pause? It makes a big difference. The correct place to pause is Kol ha'oseh malacha b'yom ha-shabbos. If you do malacha on Shabbos, comma, mos yumas. The alternative would be to say Kol ha'oseh malacha. Anyone who does malacha b'yom ha-shabbos mos yumas will be put to death on Shabbos. So you see that it's a world of difference. The words are the same. Why is this significant here? Because if you look at the words Vayakam Ha'am, Kol Hayom Hahu Nechol Halayla, something is very striking here. I think that we would be inclined to put the words Hayom Hahu together, because Hayom Hahu means that day. That's how we translated the Pasuk. The nation rose up all of that day and all of the night. So the words Hayom Hahu really should go together. The problem is, the Pasuk doesn't put them together, or more correctly, the Tamei HaMikra show us that they don't seem to go together. Because on the word Hayom, you have that sign which is called Etlisha, which is something of a pause. The word Hahu is actually led into the next phrase, Hahu V'chol HaLayla. So this is most unusual. We expect that the words Hayom Hahu are joined together by the Tamim, but the Tamim do not join them together. They tear them asunder. The question is why? They prize them apart. Says the Meshech Chochma, in so doing, the Tamei HaMikra are giving us a signal. There is no question that the word Hahu qualifies the word that came before it, Hayom. Hayom Hahu means that day. But the Tamim don't put them together. They make you pause in between the two. Why? Because in so doing, they are releasing that second word Hahu, releasing it from exclusively qualifying the word Hayom. It doesn't exist just to qualify the word Hayom. But what else has been mentioned in the Pasuk aside from the day? If it's not that day, what else can it be? There's only one other entity that's been mentioned in the Pasuk so far, and that is the Am. In other words, if the Ta'amim had put the words Hayom Hahu together as one, Hayom Hahu, then Hahu just means that day. And it doesn't mean that anything else, because it's locked in to the day. That day, and it's not qualifying anything else. But by prizing them apart, it is of course qualifying the day, but not only qualifying the day. Not only that day, but also that am. Which am? Not the whole am, but that am. The one that got the whole thing started in the first place. The asafsuf, those troublemakers, and they were the ones. And that's why, not only intuitively do we assume that it wasn't everyone that went out to collect these quails, and not only does the Targum Yonus of Ben Uziel explicitly state that it was only people who were of lower stature that went out, diminished faith that went out, but you actually see a signal from this in the pasuk that the word hahu, that is freed from just connecting to the word hayom, so that it's also able to connect back to ha'am, giving you the equivalent of vayakam ha'am hahu kol hayom hahu v'chol halayla. These are very, very delicate observations. We see what a difference it makes in the slight shift in cadence, and then the pasuk opens up. Well, from here, let us just conclude. We've done some, parshanut work this evening. We have next week to recover, but let us conclude by referring to the episode with Miriam and Moshe, and that's in Perek Yud Beis. So as we know, well, there's many ways to explain it, but whatever it was that Miriam and Aaron spoke about, it incorporated the fact that they did not appreciate that Moshe's level of prophecy was categorically higher than theirs. Hashem doesn't just speak with Moshe, he also speaks with us, yes, but not in the same way. And therefore, whatever they criticized Moshe for doing was done without that knowledge. In any case, Miriam is smitten with tzaras, according to Chazal, so is Aaron. And Moshe davens for her. And that's in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayitzak Moshe el Hashem le'mor. Moshe davens to Hashem, saying, Kael na refa na la. Hashem, please heal her. Interestingly, we don't have time to get into this just right now. It's Hashem on a future occasion. But if I'm not mistaken, the Zohar HaKadosh itself discusses the question as to when you daven for someone, do you need to mention their name? Do you need to say who they are? We know if people need a mishaberach, it's an important thing. You say their name. Here, Moshe doesn't say Miriam's name. However, the Zohar distinguishes between whether you're in the presence of the person. If they're there, you can talk about them just with the pronoun. Please heal her. You don't need to say who she is. But if you're not in their presence, then perhaps it is more significant to mention their name. Either way, there's many halachic discussions about that. But Moshe davens that Miriam should be healed. And Hashem responds, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. Hashem responds in the following way. Pasuk Yudalet. V'aviha yorok yorak b'faneha. Had her father spat in her face, meaning had he shamed her, Halo tikalem shivas yomim. She would be shamed for 7 days. So the answer is, the prognosis is, tisager shivas yomim michutz lamachane. Therefore, let her be sectioned away outside the camp for 7 days. Vachar teaseh, and then she can come back. And so it was. So in other words, this pasuk is basically describing why it is that she should have tzaras for 7 days. She will be healed, but not straight away. 7 days. Why? Because if her father shamed her, it would be 7 days. And what is the point of the pasuk, as the Gemara explains? And Rashi quotes that if her father shamed her, and it would last 7 days, so then kal vachomer, if Hashem shames her, all the more so. In fact, one might be inclined to say, well, if it's more the more so, then maybe she should be in quarantine for more than 7 days, because it's much more. I mean, it's infinitely more, but she can't stay quarantined forever. But it should be significantly more. But this is where we learn that a kal vachomer can never learn more in the chomer case than it does in the kal. It just means it's all the more so. You'll never get more in the stringent case than you do in the lenient case. It's just all the more so, you will see, but not all the more, just all the more so. So in other words, if the standard duration would be 7 days, so all the more so it should be 7 days, but it's not more than 7 days. That's a principle that's known as dio for those who are familiar with it. Either way, the Mezrich Magid asks a very simple question, and that is, you know, seemingly there's time for everything. I mean, to say, she's sick, she's smitten with Tzaraas, Moshe's davening for her, and if the answer is that she'll be sick for 7 days, she'll have Tzaraas for 7 days. So that's the answer. I mean, it could be that the background is this Kal Vachomer, and if her father, and then certainly if I have shamed her, that all may well be true, but is this really the most appropriate juncture to go into the whole pilpul of how it works and why it should be, as opposed to just the result, which is 7 days. I mean, that's the answer to Moshe's prayer. It's an interesting shaila. I mean, we seem to have kind of elaborate background to the answer, elaborate Kal Vachomer background, exegetical background. But Moshe's really just asking for it to get better. He's not asking for a sheer klali or something like that. And that's what the Maggid said as follows. It's an idea that we've mentioned in various contexts, and it's a fascinating idea. I believe it's traced back to the Rokeach, who's already from the Rishonim, the Rama Mipano, and others. We are familiar with the concept of the Yud Gimel Midos. 13 Midos. Now, the 13 Midos of what? Well, it depends. Because actually there's two sets of 13 midos. There's the 13 midos of Rachamim in Parshas Kisisa, right? Hashem Hashem, Karachem Achanu, etc. And there's the 13 midos, Shatur Nidreshes Bahen, which is Rabbi Yishmael's 13 principles. They're in the Siddur just before Pesukei Dezimra, just after the Korbanos. That's where they live. Often mentioned. My father, Zatzal, used to say, sometimes if a person comes late for sure, the first thing to be sacrificed are the korbanos. But either way, these two sets of 13 are connected. They're parallel. We say generally, as a general concept, that involvement in Torah learning arouses divine mercy. It's true generally, but it's also true specifically. Involvement in one of the midos through which the Torah is expounded, that arouses the corresponding midah of mercy. There's a parallel between these two sets of 13. And for our purposes, if we consider Moshe's prayer, the first of the midos, as far as the Arizal and the Vilna Gaon is concerned, is the word kale. In their understanding, Hashem, Hashem, or calling upon Hashem, the midos begin with kale. And Moshe invokes, it speaks to Hashem invoking that midah. Kael na'rafan Allah. Because ale means strong. It's the midah through which Hashem bestows strength. So if someone is sick, then they need to be strengthened and healed. So you will appeal to Hashem with the midah of kael. And that's what Moshe does. So what does Hashem answer him? Will she be healed or not? She will. And Hashem proceeds to initiate the healing process by doing what? By invoking a Kal Vachomer. A Kal Vachomer is the first of the midos Shatur Nidreshes Bahen. And therefore, that itself invokes and arouses the midah of Kael to bring about a refuah. So this was the first ever, what we could call Kal Vachomer therapy, where through the whole process of explaining why she'll be punished in the way that she is, that itself was instrumental in bringing about, in arousing the midah of rachamim that would bring about the refuah. And it's a fascinating way to look at these two sets of 13. This is the classic comment of the Mezrich Magid on Kael Na Refan Allah. Okay, we'll leave it over there for this evening. Mitzvah Hashem, we'll meet again in 2 weeks' time. Wish you all a good week. Shul Abbasur Estovos, Leklal Ulefrat. We'll meet again.